Welcome to the Mile 99 interview series with your hosts, Greg Larkin, Mike Turner, and Jessica Harris. Enjoy this episode, and we'll hope to see you on the trail soon. Hey, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to the 30th episode of the Mile 99 interview. And as you can see outside, it's still light. We had our daylight savings switching over, so we're back in the light, getting towards spring here. And so what we do is we have these live episodes every couple of weeks, and we just love to get some different athletes from our community on, and we talk to them, find out all about them, how they might have gotten started as endurance athletes, their approach to training, racing, find out some interesting trail stories, and just really dig in and find out all about them. We record, as you can tell, in front of a live Zoom audience, one take, no breaks, no cuts. Unlike the trails, what is said here is on the record forever. And as usual, I am joined by my co-host Jessica Harris and Mike Turner. Jessica, how are you doing?
I am doing pretty good. Enjoying extra sunlight. So amazing. St. Patrick's Day today. So me and the kiddos and all my work kiddos had lots of green treats. Green muffins, mini cupcakes, green frosted cookies, and looking for a lot of clovers in the grass today. So it was pretty fun.
All right. Any four leaves?
The kids found a lot. I'm not sure we actually got any.
Right on. Mike, how are you doing? You're wearing of the green, I can see.
Well, luckily my company is green, their logo. So I have like 30 green shirts.
All right.
Which makes it easy. No, doing good. Just keeping training. Cocodona. I got that going on. So I'm trying to get the miles in. Nervous. It's a long way. But, you know, I got good crew. Pacers coming in. You too.
Yeah.
It's going to be awesome. So, you know, the Mile 99 is a place that we, you know, want to like to hang out with like-minded trail running people and folks. It's a place to share our stories and our achievements, stay connected and stay inspired and stay motivated. You know, what I see in the Mile 99 is like a snapshot in time of who we are. But, you know, who we are is really built upon all those great stories that live before us and will continue to live on with all the stories that are yet lived. So I look at it as our community is merely the keepers of now. And I think this is a place where we can tell our story. That's my vision. As Greg said, Jessica is watching the interactive portion of the show. She's tracking the chat room here in Zoom. Facebook Live has a chat. So if you have questions, you can drop them in the chat room on Zoom here. And she will track them and at the end of the show, have a Q&A. If you're on Facebook, it's better if you can throw the comment on Zoom if possible, but we'll try to check that as well. And that's it, Jessica and Greg.
So I have known Sarah for a couple years. We're both on the single track race team, so which is awesome because we have a Facebook group, and so we can kind of all keep tabs on each other and stay connected, which has been really nice through COVID and everything. We became Facebook friends. We've been at some races together. We've ran into each other on the trails a couple times. And then I just saw you posted about this amazing thing. So I had to reach out and have you on our show. So how are you, Sarah?
I'm fine. I'm good. I'm all recovered from my trip across Death Valley.
Awesome.
Should I go into the description of,
well, let's I'll jump in. Okay. Well, as we sort of do sometimes, most of the time I should say, we like to just kind of get a little sense of you know, who you are, where you came from, what you do, and then we'll spend a whole ton of time diving into what you just accomplished. And it just to set the since you said the that you recovered, this was like 3 weeks ago, I think, right? Around three weeks ago.
I think I finished the 26th.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so you've had a little time to kind of reflect and hopefully sort of, you know, evaluate it in the larger sense. And yeah, we'll definitely jump into all that. But I did want to start with a little background, just sort of finding out, you know, where you're from. I know in your initial questionnaire that you submitted that we gather with our guests, said you grew up in Sacramento, and it sounds like, you know, you obviously, based on some of the other information, came into running kind of late. So we're just kind of wondering, like, what was your childhood like? And, you know, did running factor in at all, you know, through that period?
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in Sacramento, and I was on the track team in junior high school or middle school, but, you know, I wasn't that fast. And I didn't run a lot, but I always like, I kind of like to just go on sort of adventures. And, I think I would even tell my parents, you know, bye, I'm going on an adventure. And I would just take some, snacks and water and just go off like to the American River and hang out and, sometimes meet some friends. And then my dad took me backpacking a lot. So I really like the outdoors, hiking and backpacking. But I did run, you know, some smaller distances, like 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, pretty much up until I turned 50. And then that's when I kind of started getting into running more.
Wow. Yeah. So when you were a kid and you were doing the backpacking trips, how old were you around at that point?
When I actually carried, well, I think my dad probably carried most of my gear. But I remember he would have me train by walking around the house, carrying a backpack full of bricks.
All right.
So I don't know how old I was, maybe 8, 9, 10. I don't know.
I can see lots of parents on the call, like scribbling notes all of a sudden. I don't know why.
Hey, Sarah. So what was, I took my daughters backpacking when they were, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, I suppose those years. And, they just loved it. You know, it's funny. It was painful then, but they look back now and they're fond of it. I remember different stories. It was painful for them, but they look back and thinking it was best time of their life. But what were some of the places that you were thought were the most memorable when you were a kid going to, and have you been back as an adult?
Well, I really liked like the Klamath Mountains, like Marble Mountains, so the northwestern part of the state. That really sticks out. I remember finding a lot of newts in the water, and I guess, you know, there aren't that many up there now. There's some newts that are endangered. Yeah, I think you're right. I think probably at the time I wasn't as excited about the backpacking. I remember actually being kind of scared sometimes, like hearing noises at night. And but now looking back on it, you know, they're good memories, and I'm not afraid of the noises at night anymore. So
Totally. And was that as a kid? Did it feel to you like it was building self-esteem or confidence or anything like that? Do you have recollection of that? Or is it more now you look back and think, oh yeah, that may have helped. But as a kid, did you feel that at all? Like, hey, I can do this hard thing.
No, I don't think I really thought about that at the time. But looking back, I'm sure that's why I feel a lot more comfortable now in the wilderness, and it doesn't bother me to be out there alone.
Yeah, cool. Is that where, how many days were you out there for those trips usually? Do you remember?
I think we did some that were a week or more, 1 to 2 weeks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But yeah, my concept of time was probably, yeah. Maybe it seemed like 2 weeks.
Right. Right. Wow. That's amazing though. I mean, it's gotta be a great experience for a young, you know, young kid, just to be out there, especially with, you know, your parent and hopefully having some really memorable times out in the wilderness. So fast forwarding then, what about college years? Like, where did you go? We know that you're a wildlife biologist, assuming you studied that in college. Is that right?
I did. So I studied at both UC Davis and then later. So that was another thing I did later in life. Is I got a master's degree when I was 45 at CSU Sacramento. So, and I was already working as a wildlife biologist then. So I've been working for the Department of Fish and Wildlife for about 22 years. I work in the Suisun Marsh usually. So I'm like hauling gear around through a marsh. And I think that kind of helps keep me fit too. Mm. So, and it's really fun. I really enjoy my job.
So you're primarily out in the field. Is that right?
About maybe half the time.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, going to school I take a class here and there, and it's hard, you know, and I can't imagine going back and getting a master's degree. And then it sounds like you did it for just your own knowledge, because you work at the same place. So was it just purely for your own, just your own goal, not a career goal?
Yes, because I would, an advanced degree helps you get a job at the state, but I already had one. I was already kind of at the top of my pay scale at the time, so it didn't help as far as pay, but it helps me now with research projects and publishing papers, and it did take me a long time. It took me about 5 years of going part-time.
Big accomplishment for sure. So now, fast forwarding again, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, you got into running pretty late in life. I'm similar. I mean, I was an athlete prior bike racing, but, you know, just running in general, always thought, it's just going to hurt my knees and all that kind of like, you know, the sort of standard excuses and all that. But really discovered trail running, you know, late in life. And, you know, similar for you, it looks like you jumped into like a half marathon, you know, kind of in your 40s. And what prompted you to do that? Like, that was your first time out there, I guess?
Yeah, I did a lot of half marathons, I guess, mostly through my 40s. Hmm. And then I guess when I turned 50, I wanted to try a marathon. So I signed up for the Portland Marathon. My son was going to school in Portland at the time. And then kind of leading up to that, I wanted to do an epic hike. So I wanted to hike from the Mojave Desert in like near Tehachapi to the summit of Mount Whitney, and then stay overnight on the summit and then wake up on my birthday on the summit. And then hike down, and then go to Portland and run a marathon.
Nice. What was the total distance on that hike?
240.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so I met up with my husband near the end, and so we both climbed Mount Whitney together, and we saved two people's lives while we were up there.
Okay, let's hear about that.
So it was a really nice day when we got up there, and then when we were about to camp, this high wind picked up, and then the temperature just plummeted. It was a really freezing cold wind, so we decided to sleep in that stone hut that's on the summit, if you're familiar with.
I've never been to the summit. I've seen the pictures. Yeah, but I've seen a picture, I think, of that.
Okay, there's a little stone hut. It's like the size of a bathroom, maybe a little roomy bathroom. So we went and slept in there. And then maybe about 11:30 at night, this couple comes in and they're wearing shorts. And they're hypothermic. And they had been climbing up the Mountaineers route and they got lost. But then eventually they could see the outline of that little hut in the moonlight. So they made it to the hut. And they didn't have any food or water or a headlamp or anything. So we helped them get warmed up, gave them some layers and food and water. And so that was kind of interesting.
Wow. That's, yeah. I mean, you hear so many stories like that all over the place. I mean, when I lived on the East Coast, that was constantly happening up in the higher mountains, which are much smaller than Mount Whitney, but they're still, you know, weather severe and all that. And you hear about that type of thing wintertime, especially the shoulder seasons when people are thinking things are warm, but they're not, you know, lots of stuff going on there. So you and your state, I mean, you're doing a long distance hike. So I'm imagining you've got the full gear, food, all the stuff you would need for any emergency situation and that kind of thing.
Yes. And we even had emergency blankets so we could wrap them up in the blankets. And I had plenty of extra food.
Wow. And what happened the next day?
Well, they got warm enough in the night. We let them keep the blankets, but I think they gave us back all the other layers, and they were able to make it down. So,
wow. Definitely need to provide some links on show notes today for the top 10 or the 10 essentials and all that stuff, I guess. Yeah. I mean, you're out there a lot now. You're doing some pretty amazing things, very self-reliant. Obviously, we're going to dig into all that with this FKT. Do you run into that a lot? How often do you see people out there that just aren't prepared or just aren't aware of their surroundings as maybe as much as they should be?
I guess probably the biggest thing would be people running out of water, not realizing how hot it is. But other than that, I haven't come across any real emergencies that I can think of other than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had, oh boy, up near you, Mike, how many times rescues on the Stevens Trail over the last summer? So hot in the canyon out there and, you know, late in the day, over 100 degrees and people, especially with the canyons, it's an easy downhill hike. And now I got to get to the bottom and turn around and climb out. And it might take twice as long and just don't think about the water requirements. So then after, you got into some of the half marathons and all that, obviously when you say epic birthday hike, I mean, I'm thinking, I don't know, 50 miles, 60 miles, but 240. Okay. that's next level right there. That is epic for sure. And so then, I don't know, it sounds like maybe a little bit of the racing bug starts creeping in there and on trails, I should say. So how did you kind of come around to finding, you know, the idea of combining sort of the racing that you'd done on the road, and then obviously you're doing hikes on trails. Was it kind of a little epiphany, or did you know people who are already trail racing, or how did you kind of put the two together?
So I hadn't really run on a trail. I just did some road marathons after that for a couple of years. And then I think what change things was I watched just before I turned 52, I watched a documentary on the Self Transcendence 3100. So it was a woman who was 52 years old, mm-hmm. that they were focusing on, and she didn't really train that much for that race. But kind of her MO was she would just run real slow and easy, and she could do that all day, every day for 3,100 miles. So I thought, like, I could probably do that, you know, if I just run real slow and easy. And so then for my 52nd birthday, I just ran 52 miles just out past Winters and back to Davis. And then I thought, and then I started looking up races that were like 50 miles. And they're all trail races because there aren't really too many road races that are 50 miles. And so then that's when I found the Pioneer Spirit race that Single Track Running puts on. So I signed up for that. And then that's when I really discovered Auburn. So I started like running segments of that trail. And then I just kind of fell in love with the Auburn trails. And then that race was just really cool. Just all the people, it was so much more personal than those big road marathons, like the CIM and the Portland Marathon. It was, I mean, the people were just, I remember at one aid station when it was really hot. So that's in July, or yeah, I think that was July. Mm. It was really hot, and some woman at the aid station just took my bandana and like rolled up a bunch of ice in it and tied it back around my neck. And that like stayed like icy for a couple hours. It was so cool. And she, and so that's when I really got into the trail running. But I'm pretty slow, so I have to choose races that have a generous cutoff time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've heard similar stories from other guests over the last year, you know, just transitioning from road to trail and just finding the love there. They go into these aid stations, people are helping you, they're encouraging you, they're motivating you. You feel terrible, but they just kind of like say, oh, you got to get up. We're going to give you some food, you know, rest, give you a Coke or whatever. And you go on your way, you know, and you can feel the support there. And I love that personal aspect of all those people out there, the aid station. Sounds like that was really appealing to you as well. So then you did your first 100 miler last year, right? Is at Cool Moon?
That was the first one I finished.
Yeah, nice.
Not the first one I started.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, hey, whatever it takes. I mean, that's a great race put on by our very own member of the Auburn community, Martin Sengo. Really tough race though, I'm guessing. I mean, I've not done it. I've been there at the aid stations, like not as a volunteer, but just kind of spectating things a couple times. And it's just so hot, I think, isn't it? What was your experience at that race?
Well, I loved it because, I mean, well, first of all, Martin is just, he was out there all the time. So when I would go on my training runs, he'd be out there like doing something, maintaining the trail, whatever, or just going for a run. And so that felt really personal, just getting to know him. And then I ran all those trails in the heat. So I got used to, you know, how much water I'd need and just getting used to the heat out there. And so it went pretty well. And I liked the generous cutoff time, the 40 hours. So, and I took almost all of that time.
Both those races you're talking about are hot. They're known for hot races. And not everybody can handle a hot race. I mean, Pioneer Spirit, I mean, I call it Pioneer Broken Spirit. it's hot. And then Cool Moon is hot. And, you know, how do you do well in the heat? Death Valley is the FKT coming up. You know, do you do well in the heat? Or, I mean, was it challenging for you?
I do well in the heat, I think, more than maybe other people. I know once in Death Valley, I was hiking, and I was actually just standing there looking at, I had a little temperature sensor on my backpack, and it said 119. So, yeah, I'm kind of used to the heat.
I guess so. So let's talk about that. You know, we got a lot to cover with Death Valley and your FKT, but it sounds like you were really familiar with Death Valley in general prior to this attempt, and I would hope so, at least going on recons and other things. But can you kind of give us a timeline of, you know, how long you've been familiar with that area, how much time you've spent down there, where you've explored, and then what was the genesis of the FKT attempt?
Okay, sure. I mean, I feel like I've been familiar with Death Valley for a long time, but it's actually probably only been like 6 years. And I've hiked all over Death Valley and I love it. It's my favorite place to be, maybe not in the middle of summer. Although you can go there because like Telescope Peak is over 11,000 feet. Mm. So there are high elevation areas to hike even in summer. So I pretty much explore Death Valley whenever I can. And sometimes I go with friends and sometimes I go by myself. So I had crossed Death Valley just to go up the canyons to explore. I never actually hiked down the length of Death Valley, but I was kind of familiar with most of it. Just not like the very north end and the very south end. The north end has this canyon, Last Chance Canyon, that I had never been in. So that's why I wanted to do a few recon hikes before I tried this. And kind of I can't remember why I first discovered this. I think it was on the fastestknowntime.com website. I noticed that there were some routes in Death Valley. And most of them don't even have a woman who has done the route. So I noticed that the north to south crossing had no woman represented. And actually no one had ever done it self-supported. Someone had done it, a couple of guys had done it unsupported. So that means they carried all their water and food. So like the guy who holds the FKT now started with a 90-pound pack. So I considered doing that for a very short period of time. I bought a weighted vest and I sort of wore it around for a while, but it's not even close to 90 pounds. Mm. And I'm like, I can't do that. But I have cached food and water in the desert before. I've hiked the lowest to highest. So that's Badwater to Mount Whitney. But I only made two caches there. This was six caches. So, So then I just started kind of planning and doing a little recon on where I could cache. And I wanted to take a look at the north end that, because I knew it had kind of a sketchy downcline from the top of the canyon down into the canyon. And I wanted to make sure I could do that. So, and also I wanted to kind of see how many miles I could do. I usually, when I go there, I'm looking at things, plants and animals, and I'm not really doing the big miles. So I didn't really know what I could do over that terrain. So that's why I wanted to do a few recon missions first. So then I picked my week and hoped it was good weather.
Yeah, like at this time, I don't know if we mentioned it already, this was late February that you did this. And what are the weather conditions typically? I mean, we all, of course, know kind of the reputation of Death Valley. And I even noticed on the FKT site that there's a separate category for people who do it in July and August, which they should probably have a separate record for that because there's certainly much more difficulty with the heat. But what at this time of year, what's it like in Death Valley?
Right. So actually that the summer one is on the road because you have to push a cart because there's really no way you can carry all that water in the summer cross country. Although I guess you could do it somehow with caching water. That would be a little harder. So the weather at the beginning, it's 6,300 feet. So You know, it's like forest. It's pinyon pine, juniper forest. There was snow on the ground. The week before, when I did the recon, it snowed on me. So, and then when I got down to the valley floor, I think the highest temperature was about 85 at the end of February. So that's kind of about the range. It froze the first two nights. My water froze, so it was probably about 30 degrees the first night.
So you went from freezing to 119 degrees.
Well, it wasn't 119 that trip.
Oh. So real quick, can you, a lot of folks are new to FKTs and they're the different styles and different types. Could you quickly recap the what's unsupported versus supported and self-supported and what they mean?
I will try, but just to get it, if you really want to do one, you should go to the website, thefastestknowntime.com, and look at the actual rules. But in general, there's unsupported, and that actually has various meanings. It usually means you carry everything, and you don't get any supplies anywhere. And then there's supported, which means somebody might meet up with you and hand you food and water and, or set up a camp for you or something like that. For the shorter distances, it just mostly means food and water. And then self-supported means, in this case, it meant that I couldn't go out there are a couple of stores I could have potentially stopped at, but I didn't stop at any of those. I cached all my own food and water. But if you're looking at self-supported for like the Pacific Crest Trail, it just means you took care of yourself, even if you had to go out and go to a store or something. That's just too long of a trip to cache all your own food or water. So some of the rules are kind of, maybe just for that particular route. And this one, had no, you couldn't go on any roads or trails. Mm-hmm. And there's also male and female FKTs. And then there are multiple person FKTs, like groups.
I was reading through the rules the other day because we were putting some links together, and the show notes will actually link together that website. But I read a new rule on there that as February 4th of this year, they have a spectating rule. If you have a spectator, that makes you a supported effort. So if friends come out and give you moral support and take a picture, they consider that support. And so that becomes a supported effort. I guess it's just as of February. So that's interesting to think that even moral support could be considered a support at this point. So it's very interesting rules. You go to the website and there's all kinds of rules in there. So it's good to check out the route and then decide which one of these can I pull off. It sounds like that's what you were kind of figuring out. And based on the route, which one of these can I do?
Right. Yeah, that's it. That's why it was kind of hard to. So my friend Kathy met me at the end to take me back to my car, and I knew she had like a cold beer. So I'm like walking by her, don't hand me that beer. You can't hand it until I get to the end. Turn my GPS off, take a picture of myself, and then have that beer.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I mean, so this actual trail, or not trail, I mean, this route that you were following, completely off trail then, I mean, that's part of the definition on the FKT site, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And so for you, I mean, you can, I think there's GPX files and things like that that get uploaded for previous attempts. Mm-hmm. Did you use those a lot for planning, or were you just relying on previous visits that you had done to kind of put everything together? Like, how did you actually figure out where to go and what to follow?
I did load one of those onto my phone, you know, just in case I got lost or something. But I did, I tried to figure out a better route than what they had. And I did look at different routes. And I did change what the previous person, the route I had on my phone, I changed that a little bit in the end. And it didn't really work out. So I actually had to make this big loop back to the that GPS line because I got into this. I'm not sorry I went that way because I tried to follow a riverbed, the Amargosa River, and it was really pretty for about the first 3 miles, but then it gets to be like a swamp. And it was really hard to walk through, and I got my feet all wet and muddy, and it got really, really slow, and so I had to get out of there. So I did, and I veered away from that line off and on. I ended up going a few more miles, about 174 versus the 160 that's on the website. So just trying to find a path through some of the harder terrain.
Yeah, I think I read on the description that it doesn't really matter where you go between the start and the finish. That's kind of up to you. It's just a question of how fast can you get from point A to point B using whatever that you think the best way to do it is. Right. So one of the other things that we're curious about is this caching effort. So that's a big thing you got to do before you even start this. So that's almost like a whole separate planning, it sounds like. And what were the things that you had to do to make sure that your caches weren't disturbed, that you could find them when you're out there and maybe not in your like completely, you know, fully, you know, in the right frame of mind, maybe after a long day or something like that? Like, what kind of challenges did you have there?
So I thought about this a lot, and I changed my cache, the amount of water and food and the locations a lot up until the time I actually made the caches. In fact, even like that, the day before, when I was still making caches, I changed some locations. So I was looking for like landmarks that I wouldn't miss. Like a certain hill, and they were all pretty much at road crossings or near a road. I was looking for like ground that was already disturbed, so I wouldn't be, you know, a lot of animals burrow underground in the desert. I didn't want to like dig up a tarantula or something. So it was, I wanted some place that didn't look like habitat for something. And some, actually, when I was practicing the caching, I buried the food bag on the bottom of the hole, and then I put the gallon jug on the top. And when I first practiced this, I buried it, and then I practiced like trying to dig it up just with my hands, and I was digging like maybe 8 inches away from it. I walked away, and then I came back, and then I started digging, and it's like, where is it? You know, I thought it was right here, but it was actually like really close. So then I had to figure out a way to get the exact location, so I wouldn't have to waste a lot of time digging around. And I used some tips from this hiker named Buck 30. And he's posted some tips about caching food in the desert. And he recommended to use a little flagging tape. So I had some orange like fluorescent flagging tape. So I would tie that around the jug and then have it just barely stick up. So there was just like this little tiny orange piece of flagging tape sticking up. And then I also put my ETA and a date on the strip of flagging tape, just in case someone did pick it up and think it was, you know, garbage that they should carry out. And it worked out pretty well. I also GPSed all those locations and I ended up finding them easily even without the GPS point.
That's great. Yeah. So I mean,
I saw my footsteps usually.
Oh, like where you had been there before. Yeah. Yeah. And you said they were kind of near road crossings, because I was wondering, well, this is like an off trail effort. So did you have to hike in, but maybe not, maybe you were able to just drive to these spots and kind of go off the road a little ways.
Most of them. There was just one I hiked in. Yeah.
And so no disturbance the whole way of any animals or people or anything like that?
No. And they were all really cool underground. I mean, I was thinking later, I should have buried some beers. Because they stayed really cool.
Get that natural earth cooling going yeah. on there. A little cellar in the desert.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I checked out, I think the article, you may have linked to it in your FKT report on postholer.com or something like that. And I read through that person's kind of description of how they, you know, buried things and cached things out there. And I think there was one little anecdote in there about between the time he cached something and the time he went to retrieve it, there had been sort of like a flood or something like that in the area. And it kind of eroded his hole and his cache sank about a foot down or something like that, like in the desert. So it provided some extra challenge. So yeah, I mean, you kind of never know what's going to happen, but luckily for you, you know, you had the flagging tape and were able to find things really well. But does that put any extra pressure on you as you're out there thinking or wondering, is this thing going to be there? Am I going to find it? What am I going to do to mitigate if I can't? Like, do you have to think about that stuff?
I did. I did think about it kind of constantly. So my plan was to pretty much be out of water by the time I got to my next cache. So I wouldn't be carrying a lot of water, but I ended up hoarding the water because I was afraid that I'd get to my next cache and there wouldn't be any water there. So some little anxiety there, but.
Yeah, that seems like like it'd be nerve wracking, but and I'm curious about the caches. It's just fascinating. I never thought about burying them. I never thought about it, but you have to think about like the geology and where the river channels are and get a good spot that's going to drain. And then and you're thinking about the ecology and an area that's already disturbed. So you're not disturbing the natural ecosystem there. And then that's fascinating. But in the cache, you had clothes in there too, or did you have just food? And did you put your old garbage in there on your way back? Or how did you, like, what did you leave something there on your way out?
So it was just, so I made six caches altogether. Two were just water. Four also had food, and one had extra socks and some wipes and a extra battery charger. That I think that was all. And then everything I carried out. So I carried out all my garbage, including toilet paper and other people's garbage, because I found, so you find Mylar balloons in the desert a lot. So I had 12 Mylar balloons that I packed out as well.
I think I saw a picture of those on your FKT report too. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, including one. So I think it was, I started on February 22nd and I found a red heart. So it must have been, and it was still had air in it. So it was from Valentine's Day.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that one was pretty fresh.
Wow, we sure appreciate you cleaning things up. I mean, those balloons, from what I've heard, just last absolutely forever. Even in an environment like that, they're out there for a long time. So that's great. Moving into kind of gear choices, what did we already ask, or did you say like how heavy your pack was, and what kind of, do you have to adopt a real minimalist attitude, especially with this type of effort? And what do you do to accomplish that if you do?
So my, without food and water, my base weight was 10 and a half pounds. So my backpack itself weighed 1 pound. I really love this backpack I got, the Virga 26. So that's like my new favorite pack. And I kind of went back and forth on my sleep system. I was planning on taking a more minimalist, maybe not even a tent, just a minimal pad and a lighter sleeping bag. And kind of at the last minute, I took a 2.5 pound sleeping bag and a tent and a 1 pound inflatable sleeping pad. So I kind of went for the cushier sleep system. Not sure if I do it again and I try to go a lot faster, I don't know if I would do that, but it sure made the trip more enjoyable because I slept really well. So I pretty much just like hiked all day, you know, and slept a long time and got up and hiked some more.
Yeah. I was looking at the timing on your daily reports, and it looks like you got a good amount of sleep every night. I mean, 8-9 hours or more, maybe.
Yeah. Actually, when I look back, so my Garmin watch will record how long I sleep. And it was like 9.5 hours a night.
Wow. All right. So, and then you got like the sleep quality rating out there. And
yeah. So there was one night that there was a high wind and a sandstorm, so I didn't sleep very well that night. But other than that, yeah, I slept really well. Like one night I slept on a sand dune, just cowboy camped out on a soft dune. It was really beautiful. Slept a long time that night. Yeah, it was.
So I saw that term in your report also, cowboy camping. And so I have an idea, but why don't you describe what that is? And maybe some other people have not heard of that.
Okay. So cowboy camping is just camping without a tent, just under the stars.
And what does that feel like when you're out in the middle of Death Valley by yourself? I mean, where are the closest people? Obviously you had reports of all different kinds of wildlife. Does your training as a wildlife biologist kind of just give you this sense of calm when you're out there with all kinds of, you know, wild animals and other things and no one else around, or what does it feel like?
Oh, it's really relaxing. And then you know, of course the night sky there. I mean, there was kind of a moon. It ended up being a full moon on the last night. But the night sky is amazing. And once I woke up, when I was on the dune and I saw this like amazing shooting star that just went across the sky, and then I went back to sleep. And yeah, it's just really cool. And I think the only time I got a little nervous when I was hiking down the canyon and the first night I hiked into the dark, and I was looking at the ground, and then I looked up and I just saw the eye shine of some big animal. And just for a moment, kind of my heart skipped. I thought maybe it was a mountain lion, which would have been cool, but it was pretty close. But then I realized I saw a couple more sets of eyes. I realized they were bighorn sheep. So that was really cool. Yeah, just all the other wildlife. Coyotes, kit fox, kangaroo rat. Yeah, it was just really cool to see them all. And I had a really curious kit fox at that camp. And on the dunes. It just came right up to me three times. You know, just right up once it just, it sniffed my bag. A couple other times it came right up to me. So that was really cool.
Yeah. Sounds like a great experience. I mean, you're just out there kind of in just the vast expanse. I can only imagine what that must feel like. And so when you're experiencing those things and when you're on the trail or not the trail, as the case may be, and you're actually walking, what are the types of things that are going through your mind? What are you thinking about? Do you have any of those kind of doubts creeping in? And if you do, you know, how do you resolve those? Or are you pretty much just so enjoying this just vast landscape?
Well, since I've been to Death Valley a lot, I passed by a lot of the places that I had hiked before. A lot of them I had like a GPS location, so I would cross that location. I would see it on my phone. So it kind of brought back all the memories of all those trips, and some of those trips were really cool. So that was fun. And then I like to botanize a little. Normally I look at plants a little closer, but I didn't have as much time. And then I started to see lizards. And so I like to ID the lizards and then the tracks that are in the, usually I'd walk in a sandy area. And so I'd see animal tracks and try to identify those. I have like 100 pictures of animal tracks from that trip. And, so that's pretty cool. But then it also kept going through my mind about kind of calculating how much water I had and how much water I need, and the battery power that I would need to charge all my, because I had to prove that I was there. I couldn't let my GPS tracker run out of batteries. And so I was thinking about all that. Like, so that's probably what I thought about like half the time. I mean, normally it wouldn't have mattered that much if I had run out of something, because I was within like 15 miles of a road, 12 to 15 miles of a road or something. So, but for the FKT, I had to think about that more.
What kind of battery charger did you have? Because I know Garmin watches don't last 5 days. So what did you use for charging? Do you have any?
So I didn't charge my Garmin watch at all. I didn't keep, I only used it pretty much for time. I guess maybe I did a little bit until I realized it was, I couldn't charge it that much. So I had a charger, one was like the size of a deck of cards that could charge your phone like three times. And I had a smaller one that I put in one of my caches. Let's see, I can't think of the brand. But anyway, so I had a Delorme tracker, the InReach. And I had that set to just take a point every 5 minutes. So it wouldn't run out of power. And then I charged my phone, and I thought I would charge my headlamps and hike at night more, but I ended up not hiking at night very much. So I had plenty of battery power left.
So the InReach is what you used to prove, or what recorded the route? Was it an InReach Mini, or was it the full InReach, the bigger one?
It was the Mini.
And that recorded your route, and that's what you used to upload as proof, so not your watch, but you use that. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think my watch, I would have to charge it up like every day.
Yeah. Interesting.
Cool, yeah, so I mean, just all those different things you have to think about while you're out there. I can only imagine all the, you know, you've done the preparation. Obviously you went and you know, did the trips down there, made sure you knew where you were. But did you see anybody while you were out there that would give you kind of any indication that, you know, where you were? I mean, you already knew kind of GPS based where you were, but like any contact with anybody while you were out there?
No, only people like in vehicles when I could see a road.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, nobody.
Wow. Incredible. I mean, I think we all, you know, can appreciate just the solitude and being out there, but that's serious. I mean, four, 5, 6 days, not seeing anybody, that's a long time. But you obviously had the mindset for it. And one of the things I'm wondering is for, you know, we've talked about various FKTs on the show over the past 6, 8 months or more even. And, you know, one of the things I'd like to know from the people who do them is what kind of advice might you give to somebody who's looking and doing something like this? Is there, you know, is it just kind of like go for it, or, you know, what type of preparation would you suggest? You know, what helped you the most, I guess, to prepare for something like this?
Well, you can look at if somebody's done it already, you can look at their report, their trip report. Most of them have one. Just go out there. I mean, if it's a long trip, like days, then just do a little recon, maybe do sections of the route, just to kind of get an idea of it. Or especially if anything is you're not sure about, like getting through a canyon or I don't know, or just like that sketchy down climb I had to do to get in the canyon, just anything that might be more unknown than anything else, it would help to just go and check it out.
Yeah. Sounds very much like what we always like to, as we're doing any trail race, go out, check out the course, make sure you know all those little bits and pieces. And yeah, especially if there is a pretty sketchy down climb, that sounds like something you'd want to try and maybe do before you actually get there and make the attempt. So good planning advice there for sure. Well, we just want to congratulate you on that accomplishment. Really amazing. Anybody that hasn't seen that FKT report, it's really engaging. There's tons of information in there that you've provided. And also just be aware of the fact that there's only like, I think, enough people that I can count on my one hand that have done this, you know, either in supported or unsupported or self-supported form. So it's really a testament to your will to do that. So congratulations.
Thanks.
And we're kind of getting to the end of the show. So to wrap it up, we're going to have a rapid fire question game real quick. First thing that comes to your mind when I ask you a couple questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
Nothing hard. It's nothing hard. Okay. Road or trail?
Trail.
Trail. Duh. I know, right?
Well, off trail.
Yeah. Oh, I should have added that.
All right.
Favorite beer?
Oh, let's see. Something, how about Heretic, like Evil
Twin?
Twin, is that the one that's really like IBU of 100 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one.
Awesome. What did you have when you finished? Do you remember?
Oh,
You're like, no, it didn't matter. It was beer. It was calories. That's what it was.
No, can you unmute Robert? Because is Kathy still there? If she remembers, it was an IPA.
Hazy IPA.
There you go. Thank you. We needed to know.
It was the one who supplied the beer.
Uh-huh.
Aha. That's an important person.
Right.
And then bucket list race.
Oh, a race. Mm-hmm. Not hike. Oh. Well, I don't know if it's a bucket list, but I kind of have looked at those stage races, like the ones that are in the desert.
Shocking.
I always kind of look sort of longingly at those. But yeah, as far as bucket list.
Someone in the chat is wondering if you're interested in doing Badwater.
Yeah, I used to be more interested in it, but since it's all on a road, I'm not quite as interested as I used to be, but it still does interest me.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you have to run on like the paint of the road because your shoes will melt. That's just crazy.
Right.
Next question, another post-race or post accomplishment, what do you eat after all of this? After a big 170 mile FKT, what do you eat when you get home?
Well, when we got to the campground, we stayed overnight in Death Valley. We had a black bean burger and fries and more beer and champagne.
Aw, that's awesome.
Yeah, that was delicious.
And then this is a big one. We ask all our guests, you've seen one of mine today, cat or dog?
Well, I actually have more cats than dogs, but I prefer dogs.
Oh, you know, obviously, Greg really likes his cats. Mike,
do you want my cats?
Don't tell him that. He will take them and he doesn't need more. I have two dogs and I have a cat and I have a rabbit. And my cat is my most recent pet that I've got. And I just love her so much. So right now, because cats are so easy, I'm team cat.
Oh, wow.
But I have dogs. And I love them. They're just so much work, right? So much work.
But they're worth it. They're better.
Oh, totally. I feel safe. I run with my dogs. They just are big. I got big dogs.
I'm like an uncle to animals. I just have them for like a week. I dog sit, I cat sit, but I have nothing permanent, just stuff that I temporarily watch.
I'm going to have you watch my rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Awesome. Add something to your resume.
Well, thanks a lot, Jess. And we got a little more insight here, and I think I'm craving some fries right now. So
any potatoes for Greg.
That's yes. My potatoes are kind of my thing. So well, thanks so much, Sarah. We really enjoyed speaking with you tonight, getting to know you, hearing all about, you know, kind of how you came all up through the sport of running and this most recent accomplishment, which is super impressive. And I think, you know, as I said, we're going to have a lot of interesting links in the show notes. So please, everybody, go check out her FKT report. I found it really interesting, tons of detail in there. If you're thinking about doing anything like that, it doesn't have to be even Death Valley. There's like lots of great tips. And I think you took pictures of all your gear and all that stuff. So it's really helpful. So thank you, everybody. We're going to wrap it up for tonight. We'd love it if you would visit us at themile99interview.com, our website. You can also find us on Facebook, of course, The Mile 99 Interview, as well as Instagram at The Mile 99 Interview. Sounds like a broken record, but that's where we are on all the socials. We love it if you drop us a little review in there. We'd love to hear from you, engage with us as we do our posts and all that. We love that. We'll be obviously announcing more episodes with lots of interesting people coming up, and look for those. And also the gear reviews that Mike has really taken on, and they seem to be doing really well. People are enjoying those, and I'm sure we're going to have lots of good stuff coming that way as well. So thank you, everybody. Have a great night, and we will see you on the trails. Bye-bye.